Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Dave Weiner here, and we got another episode of Rebooting the News. Jay, you there?
I am here.
Hey Jay, Jay Rosen, right? NYU.
That's right, Greenwich Village, from the heartland of Greenwich Village.
The heartland of the United States, right? I mean, that's where it all happens, right?
We've both been on the road, and we actually missed a week of, or took a hiatus for a week of Rebooting the News, so there's quite a bit to catch up on.
Totally. You want to go first? What do we have to catch up on?
Well, actually, I wanted to hear about your trip to Denmark and Berlin, and I was hoping that you could just angle the story at what you learned about Rebooting the News in those two places rather than a general travelogue, because I would just... It would just be great to see what learnings you take back to this discussion from there.
It's funny. You know, usually I don't get my great epiphanies for, like, weeks after. You know, it's like first you throw all your cards in the air and then you sort of look at the how they all landed. And, I mean, I have a lot that I learned from I've been to Denmark, to Copenhagen. This is my third trip there. So, and I go there for this conference called Reboot, not Reboot.
Right, Reboot. That's one of the connections right there.
Yeah, so it's Reboot. And the guy who is the mentor of Reboot, Thomas Madsen Migdal, is a wonderful guy. He shares all of the philosophy that we have, basically, that, you know, we're... Yeah, well, let's not go into it. Obviously, we've done 14 episodes. It's hard to characterize it. But and I like going to it because it's far away from Silicon Valley. And,
right.
And so it's but it's tech, and it's also young. So the people are like in their 20s and their 30s, and mostly optimistic. There are a lot of people that do. You know, stuff that is in our area, you know, news organizations from Europe, mostly. I mean, there aren't that many people who come from the U.S. to this conference.
You're saying 10 people working for news organizations in Europe?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Not, I mean, I wouldn't say a predominance of them, but that's who I generally tend to talk with because, you know, that's my view of the world. And I had a number of meetings and unfortunately, with these sorts of meetings, I can't say who they were with. I mean, that's why I'm sort of reluctant to make this a trip report. But, you know, the news is rebooting in Europe, maybe not in the same way as in the U.S., because the news organizations tend to be government-sponsored, so they're not dealing with the same financial issues that our American papers are. Like, for example, The Guardian in the U.K., I don't think The Guardian can go out of business because they have this, you know, endowment that keeps them going. The BBC.
Yeah, they have an unusual structure there.
All of them. AFP, another one. You know, the French government is heavily involved in that. So, I mean, the real shocker for me of this trip was Berlin. I mean, you know.
And what did you do there?
I was a tourist. Just a tourist. You know, a tourist who has deep roots in that area, you know, from a family standpoint. My grandmother was from Germany and was a Protestant, not Jewish. And then three-quarters of my heritage is Jewish, and all of it, you know, was uprooted during that war. And Berlin is a very, you know, sort of, it's a real place, you know. If we like to think that change, you know, we're dealing with a lot of change here in the United States, they could teach us a thing or two about change.
Considering the journey they've been on,
it's amazing. And so I spent my time there. I was a historic tourist, basically. I spent the whole afternoon at the German History Museum, and that was what I was trying to get a sense of, is of the history of that part of the world.
You know, one of the things about the European model in media that interests me is that if you are a more recently born republic, you have a sense of how the media are central to building the nation, you know? They're like part of the infrastructure of nationhood because you have to create these institutions like German broadcasting, you know? And you have to think about, well, what do we want them to be? Mm-hmm. And in our country, the government has sort of done the same thing. The media system we have is a creation of law. It's a creation of the government. But the mythology is that the media system is turned over to business somehow. And anyways, in Europe, they have a closer touch, I think, between news and information, political journalism, and the life of the nation, because they need institutions that will support Danish journalism, you know?
Right.
And the politics of it are just different than ours, where we have...
Well, you made a comment on Jeff Jarvis's blog, I think it was yesterday or earlier today, about the arrogance of U.S. journalism to think that it's... Well, arrogance wasn't the word you guys were talking about. You were talking about narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
To think that it was... That it's an organ of democracy. You know, this is a... You hear this all the time.
Or equivalent to democracy, yeah.
But it's not. I mean,
no,
journalism
it's not, no.
is not. Absolutely not, right? I mean...
No, I have tried to argue directly against this conceit that journalism is the only profession mentioned in the First Amendment, for example. I think that's a very bad idea, that journalism schools had no business transmitting to students and journalism faculty had no business believing it.
Because it's not true. There
it's
is
not
the word
true.
Does not
it's
appear.
Not true. If you read the First Amendment aloud, you don't find the word journalism in it.
Right.
And the idea that journalism somehow is or controls the press is certainly not true, especially professional journalism. This is the whole reason I founded my blog, PressThink, was to separate this notion of the press from the occupational group that had temporarily gained custody of it, if you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean. And I called my blog PressThink rather than MediaThink, because I actually wanted the arrow pointing backwards to this institution, because I want the new press to have, if you will, the 300-year river, you know, of history flowing directly into it. And in order to do that, you have to say to professional journalists, look, you are not the press. You are not yourselves
mm-hmm.
what the First Amendment is about. Rather, it gives everyone the powers of the press, right? And as soon as we figure out the technology for that, the easier, you know, to make it possible,
yes.
that will be
yes.
more and more true. So anyway, that's a basic belief of mine, is journalism
mm-hmm.
is not the press.
We're both members of that church. That,
yeah,
that,
many people are. And, you know, one of the cool things about journalism is there are a lot of journalists who feel that way, too. A lot of journalists feel, you know what, anybody should be able to do what we do.
Well, that
there's
goes
tons
right
who
to...
feel that way.
We got into a discussion this week with a 2-time Pulitzer winner, speaking of journalists, you know, credentialed journalists or recognized journalists, Howard Weaver, and the question came up, and I thought he put it beautifully. He said, is it news if it's not reported?
Mm-hmm.
And he answered it, too. I mean, it wasn't just like he asked the question. It was like he knew the answer, and it was perfect foil for, you know, for
mm-hmm.
a Dave Weiner piece, which I wrote from Berlin. Somehow my pieces that I write from Europe end up getting quoted a lot more than my pieces from the U.S., which makes me think I'm on the wrong continent. But
are there any? Go on. Continue
yeah.
your thought about Weaver.
Yeah. Well, so Weaver said that no, it's not news until it's been reported, which then sparked a. You know, I wrote a piece in response to that, which said a theme that I had been writing about, we've talked about it, you and I have talked about it a number of times, which is the sources have never been paid, right?
Right.
And so when you talk about, you know, news has to cost, well, then we have to figure out, well, what is the news? Did the news happen when the event happened, or did it happen when it was reported? Of course, I would say it doesn't need to be reported in order for it to be news.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't want to get into this whole question of what does it mean to be reported. I was at a MotoGP race yesterday. I took lots of pictures, and they got quoted. The pictures got used in the Italian press, and Yeah, well, I'm not a reporter. I took pictures of lots of people who had digital cameras. They were all not reporters, but
right.
those pictures are going somewhere, right? And some of them may be appearing in newspapers or on certainly on websites on Flickr and PhotoBucket, et cetera. So then everybody, so Jeff Jarvis quoted that line about the press about the resources having never been paid, and so we were sort of looking at a change in economics. And it started this whole really sort of interesting, I find interesting question as to, is it news if it's not reported? What do you think about it?
I think that the way you get out of those logical puzzles is by reference to the user group. That is news for a group of people. And I always start there. And in fact, the best way to learn journalism, in my opinion, is not necessarily to go to this school, get that certification, or publish this or that. It's to actually put yourself in a journalistic relationship to a group of people. And so if you start there, then these questions don't really make all that much sense in the abstract, but they're better off being answered in a community context. So is it news for this group? What's news to them? And there I go back a lot to what I understand information to be. I think one of the things that characterizes the way you think about this is you're very interested in new information, that part of news. And I think of information the way that information science does, which is the measure of uncertainty reduced, right? But it's also letting people know that there are new things to be uncertain about. So when you have information, it's only relevant to a group of people who have a life that they're trying to live, and they can't inform themselves easily of everything they want to know about, so they need other people to inform them. So anyway, that's where I start.
But the word news, doesn't it imply new? I mean, the first three letters are new.
Absolutely. Totally.
Okay.
It's what's new now, but...
Right.
What I'm saying is that you can't answer questions of practice outside the journalist relationship to people who are using the news.
I'm not following that. You can't explain.
What I'm saying is, if you want to understand journalism as a practice, the best way to do so is to look at social circumstances in which a journalist is serving a group of people. So it's easier to say what is news for San Jose. It's easier to say what is news for the technology community. What is news for the community of Pittsburgh Steelers fans, you see? And really, I don't think we get much in thinking about journalism.
All right, let me give you
place a journalist in a context like that. It's like you got to put your hand around them and put them in the context of doing journalism, and then we can say all kinds of things about them.
Well, I think there's another way to pick this up. This is
say,
have you ever identified, I'm going to answer this question, so have you ever identified news that had, something that was absolutely news that wasn't reported?
It happens all the time.
That was my inspiration. That's why I was blogging.
Right.
Because of that, and I don't think it was, you could ask it in terms of relevance to a community. In my case, it was, Macintosh software, and the broader tech press was reporting that there was no new Macintosh software, and in fact, there was, and they knew that there was, and somehow it became conventional wisdom that there wasn't, and, and they were members of their own subsect of the Church of the Savvy.
Mm-hmm.
In that church, there was no new Mac software, so that's what they reported.
Yeah, right.
And so, the news was happening. News stuff was actually shipping, but it wasn't not being reported. So, and then the vacuum got filled, right?
Right. It's like there's a difference between the reportable and the reported.
Right. So, Jay, the history of blogging is becoming a... it's coming to the surface now, and this will be the first time I've commented, and only to say that there are two things that are out there right now. One is an academic study by I believe that he's a graduate student. His name is Rudolf Ammann, and he is doing a series of articles that are academic treatments of the history of blogging. And the first one he wrote was about Jorn Barger. I don't know if you're familiar with Jorn. Probably.
No.
Since, no? Okay. Jorn, maybe I shouldn't even try to characterize it, although Jorn was the guy who coined the term weblog. And,
I have heard of him.
Was a very influential blogger, of course, I knew him. He was a user of my software, which was called the News Page Suite. And, in fact, all of the first bloggers, the first community of bloggers, all used this software. It was an application that ran inside of the Frontier environment, which I also created. And Jorn... And so this historian comes in. He really is a historian. I don't know his resume, but he approached it the way a historian would approach this, with no coloring and very much the facts. And I say that because it's not entirely favorable to me. Which is fine actually. I mean, people might be surprised to hear me say that. I am mostly interested in actually having the story told, so that we can talk about it, and I can use it. Because the myth of invention is exactly that. It's a myth. It doesn't work the way anybody believes it does.
Why do we want to argue about who invented blogging? I mean, that's the most boring thing in the world.
Well, when did that become an argument? Okay. You just raised that, okay?
I don't believe in the origins. Like, I think I'm on the same page with you, Dave. In that,
inventions
don't come about through heroic inventors that had this brilliant idea.
No, they don't.
It doesn't work like that at all. And I'm totally on board with that.
Good. I mean, I think the best thesis on that I've ever seen was James Burke's series called Connections, which I've recently rewatched.
We talked about it on an earlier rebooting.
Exactly. And that is how it all happens, in my experience, is that they sort of like ideas pop up, they get implemented, people learn from the implementation of those ideas. They either go somewhere or they don't, and oftentimes they don't, but you still learn from them, and they often pop up again in five generations later in somebody else's work.
You know what I find interesting about it? What I find fascinating about periods like that is there's the people that are making the technology, they're making machines, they're making the means.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who are practitioners who are picking them up, right? And the invention is really shaped by these early and expert practitioners and the people inventing the tools and the software. And then, of course, there are people who are both. The invention is really as just as much what the early practitioners see it as.
Well,
you're
going to love the story that Ammann tells, and you're going to love the story of Jorn Barger and the invention of blogging, because that is what's going on there. Jorn was very much a practitioner, a user, And go read the story. It's a great. I find it. I was very glad, very very glad to see this.
Yeah.
In response to say everything, I'm going to say nothing. That's my approach to it.
I'd love to see somebody trying to do an origins tale about civic journalism and citizen journalism.
Well, I think you find that it's all connected up with all of this stuff. I mean, it all flows. And by the way, I just want to add one more thing, is that this idea of being a practitioner, that's my secret sauce for being a technologist. That's how I do it. To me, it's meaningless. If I don't use it, I don't understand it. And so I only make tools that I then in turn use. I don't make technology just for the sake of making it. I make it so that I can use it, because otherwise it goes absolutely nowhere.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah.
I was at a conference last week, too.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes, please. Tell us about it.
what was the Personal Democracy Forum in New York, which I've attended, I think, 4 or 5 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who I know from the world of journalism, blogging, and the web were there. Several things really stood out for me. One was there was an incredible triumph in this conference in the sense that ideas that they were talking about 3, 4, 5 years ago are now close to the center of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a powerful theme of the conference, and it tells you why you start these things way, way, way on the margins. Because it is possible that someone will come to power and they'll realize we need transparency in government. You know, who are the people who have been thinking about that, right? And a lot of those people, some of whom I know, like Beth Novak and Susan Crawford, both very interesting people, very interesting thinkers, are now working for Obama. And they were there, you know. And I talked to Beth Novak, who's in charge of getting the agencies to be more transparent. And
what was she before she worked?
She's a law professor in New York who had started the Peer-to-Patent Project, which was using peer production methods to help the United States Patent Office start to open up. And she's the person primarily responsible for bringing open source into government in a practical way, in the sense that the Patent Office wants this to work, and they are cooperating with it. And so Obama brought her in to do something similar for the government as a whole. And I talked to her a little bit about it, and she's literally visiting agency heads and saying, how can we get your stuff online? How can we open you up? How can we... And she starts not with her ideas, but with what Obama said about him. So that was kind of cool. But more than that, I just had this sense that you start talking about things like transparency in government. Wouldn't it be great if even the federal government could, you know, do this and that? And eventually, sometimes, these things begin to actually happen. And this is the conference where the people inside the government who are doing the things Personal Democracy Forum had been talking about came to Personal Democracy Forum and showed them to the crowd.
Right.
And the Chief Information Officer of the United States government, whose name I cannot pronounce.
Vivek. That's his first name. Vivek, yeah.
Vivek gave an amazing presentation in...
Really?
Yes, and it wasn't a PowerPoint. It was working exclusively with websites of the federal government that are working right now. I mean, in other words, he was accessing his own sites and showing us what you can do. And even though it's just the first few steps, it does represent the democratization of public information, like a further step in the democratization of public information. And it was very exciting to watch it.
Very,
yeah.
Very quickly, right? I mean, this stuff is all just like 4 years ago, right?
Yes, exactly.
Must have seemed pretty hopeless 4 years ago.
4 years from panel discussion to in the federal government.
Wow. Well, sometimes things were just meant to happen, huh? This must have been one of them. I mean, it just is on the fast track.
Yeah, it's on the fast track, and it's only a start, and like there's so much arrayed against it. You know, it's not like it's going to win. But
yeah,
if the data is there, you can figure out how to start putting it online, and that itself is a major change. So anyway, that was kind of cool. Also really interesting was something David Weinberger said in his short presentation, which was packed with these kind of aphoristic ideas. And one of them was just put so well and so important to what we've been talking about in Rebooting the News. Here's how we put it. Transparency is the new objectivity.
Mm-hmm. Explain what that means. What does that mean?
Well, it means that instead of trying to claim that we have the authoritative view,
right?
Like, trust our account because it's objective, because we're professionals, because we know how to do this. Instead of that kind of claim, what you have to claim now is trust our account, because here's where we're coming from. Here's how we did it. Here's our information. Here's everything we know, right? And if transparency is the new way of generating the kind of claim to have an authoritative account.
Absolutely.
And it was a very important idea.
Well, it's so funny because that came up in Copenhagen as well with Weinberger. I mean, he was the common denominator in both of our last weeks because he was there in Copenhagen as well. And the way we put it there was triangulation, which is I want to be able to hear five different points of view of an event that took place, and I need to know what direction were you coming from when you gave me that description, and then I'm going to try to figure out what happened by looking at the intersection of all of those descriptions. So,
My way of putting this, Dave, my same point, is here's where I'm coming from is easier to trust now than the view from nowhere.
Well, there never was such a thing as the view from nowhere. That was a myth.
It was a way of generating cultural authority at a particular time. And what I am saying is that it is more likely that you will be trusted by saying, here's where I'm coming from, than it is if you say, I don't have a view, I'm just telling you the truth, so accept it because I'm a professional. And if I'm right, that means that defending the authority of the news media actually requires changing the model from the view from nowhere to here's where we're coming from. And that's a transition that some organizations cannot make. But a lot of people online are learning about it. Anyway, it's very interesting that Weinberger basically took the torch two places, you know?
Yeah.
And it caught fire both times.
Well, he had another idea in Copenhagen that was actually, I thought, was pretty brilliant. And it relates to a whole other topic, which is the whole question of this is a question of authority again. You know, when I was at the MotoGP thing yesterday at Laguna Seca, they were very impressed with my 23,000 followers on Twitter. And I said, well, you wouldn't be impressed if you knew what some other people had, you know, 800,000, 2 million, you know, whatever. And so authority in that world was actually on a path towards meaning something, and it went off the path. And we've talked about this many, 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 many times. And
we don't know what authority.
Well, we're now lost. We don't have. We don't have a metric for measuring it. I mean, this is what we're always striving for in the online world. You know, in Google, they have PageRank, which is telling you how important one page is relative to another, and they have all these factors that go into it, none of which happen to be whether or not you're friends with Evan Williams.
Right.
And it came up since our last show that Microsoft's search engine, Bing, their new search engine, had decided to include Twitter results in their in their search results. And then, of course, the question came up is, well, how are you deciding which of those results should you show?
Right.
It's the same thing. They're doing a mix of follower count, which means basically their ranking algorithm is how popular are you with Evan Williams, which is, you know, it keeps leading back to this same sort of problem that Twitter, as a medium that was on its path towards, in many ways, replacing the web itself. You know, sort of like, let's bootstrap the web inside the web. The internet technology is always doing things like this, you know. Let's create a whole other world. It's like do you ever see the movie Men in Black?
No, I don't think I did.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe I won't. There's an example of a whole universe.
I get the point,
Yeah, it's inside
You use the system to build a replacement for it inside it. Yeah.
Correct. It's, and of course, that's also known as a bootstrap, which is
right.
where rebooting comes from.
Gotcha.
So there was an interesting, and so Weinberger says, well, why don't we just erase the number? Why don't we just take it out of the user interface of Twitter? And a lot of people are coming to that conclusion that that is, you know, that it's so, the follower count thing is so hopelessly polluted by this,
mm-hmm.
you know, whole process that we just need to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another incident that happened, an interview between Fred Wilson, who is one of the board members of Twitter, and John Battelle, who is a, you know, famous insider in the tech industry. If, you know, again, if we had a Church of the Savvy, tech savvy, John Battelle would be one of the cardinals of it, if not the not the Pope for sure, but certainly a pretty high-level guy. And in the interview, Battelle said the thing that I expect everybody's going to be saying to Twitter soon, which is, how can I get some of that juice? How do I get on that list? You know,
mm-hmm.
he's looking and seeing all of his friends, some, you know, some of whom have, you know, 30,000 followers like he does,
mm-hmm.
and some have 700,000 followers, and he's figured it out. He
right.
understands how that happened. And so we're still swirling around this whole issue. It's still a big one. And how we solve
right.
that. Weinberger's answer might be the way it ends up getting solved, which is go look for another way of measuring this.
What we can say for sure is that we're not going to make much progress in open systems unless we can make progress in reputation systems.
That's right.
And there's a critical element of a more participatory system for news is you have to give a good answer to the natural question. How do I trust this? Who do I trust? Right?
Right.
Who are the reliable providers? And
that's
if right. we don't provide really good means for answering that question, if we don't keep improving them and continue to put time and effort and weight and intellectual focus on it, I think that the system is going to lag behind because it'll be vulnerable to settling that question, who do I trust, with either the afterglow of the incumbents, you know, or celebrity, like you said, you know, simple brute models of popularity. So rebooting the news requires making progress with sensitive reputation systems that allow us to know who's likely to be a reliable provider and has been in the past. But I think we can get there. We just have to realize that it's not just about creating new content. It's creating systems for trusting it.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the currency. You know, the content is the property. It's like an
mm-hmm.
economic system. You know, so your house is like a website. You know, there's a lot of people that you know, sort of overlay that sort of, you know, construction site and, you know, all the analogies of construction and the physical
mm-hmm.
world, or, you know, that a website is a place. All the Doc Searles is very, Doc Searles, who spends a lot of time thinking about this stuff, doesn't agree. And I see, you know, his point of view. But anyway, so if the physical world is modeled by the website, then reputation is the currency. And what is happening right now is a crisis in the currency. It's like in either hyperinflation or hyperdeflation, maybe, because we no longer have, you know, when you see it start to show up in a search engine, in the search engine market, and all of the contradictions appear right there, it's beginning, that's like almost having the currency, lack of value in the currency start to show up on the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. It hasn't shown up in Google yet because, you know, this didn't turn out to be the threat everybody thought. That,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's been a lot of sort of flaky thinking about this, that, you know, one, this is where we really need to be. We need to be, you know, having real-time search means searching, you know, the Twitterverse, right?
That's
well,
a common idea you see around, yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
People
absolutely.
Generally do say that search has to catch up, and they talk about that, yeah.
That's what they talk about when they say real time. That's what that
mm-hmm.
means.
Yeah.
But give me a break. I mean, if you look at the actual content of these 140-character tweets, I mean, even the ones that are, you know, exclusively crafted, like yours, Jay, you know, it's very hard for an algorithm to discern meaning from this. And
yeah,
that is what they have to
challenge.
Do. Yeah, that's what they have to do. Now, Google at least has full pages to go with. So Google didn't react to this. Google looks at it and, you know, they do the say nothing thing. There's nothing to say here because there's nothing that we can do with this. They've looked at it and they know that there's nothing. So there are so many things that need to be addressed. One of them is, we got to relax that 140 character limit. It's ridiculous. You know, it is, absolutely. And we got to be able to put metadata. Why are you laughing? Because it's become sacred or because, I mean, it is ridiculous. How do you feel about that?
No, I don't feel it's sacred, no. No, I just like the idea
of... we've talked about this, right,
I like the idea of, okay, let's fix this thing and, you know, like, let's make new demands, even though we know it's not that simple. So I like that spirit. I also wanted to remind you, we got about 6 minutes left, and we want to get to your source of inspiration because it is your week, so let's keep your eye on the clock.
But let me just, my eye is on the clock, but because Blog Talk Radio doesn't do 40-minute shows, we actually have 10 minutes left.
Okay.
So they do 45 minutes. Sure, I'll do the inspiration, but it's not going to take me 10 minutes to do it. And it's probably going to shock you, so I hope you're sitting down. Are you sitting down, Jay? Okay,
yeah.
My inspiration is Sarah Palin. And
Go on.
Because I think Sarah Palin, if you cut right to the core of what her story is, I think I figured out what Sarah Palin was really saying in her, you know, long winding resignation.
Really? Well,
I say that, and I sort of did a little drum roll over on Twitter before this, telling people they weren't going to believe who I chose and why. And I think she's caught in the gears of our legal system. I think that's what's happened to her. She's not that rich, and she's not rich, actually, at all. And she's under an ethics investigation in the state of Alaska, and she's having to pay lawyers. And I've been in this situation, I've not had an ethics investigation, but I've been involved in a civil lawsuit where the issue wasn't right or wrong, as much as I wanted it to be right or wrong. The issue was... am I going to survive this as a financial entity if I go all the way to a decision? And the answer was no. The answer is, if you do that, the lawyers sat me down and explained, you know, in the heat of all of the arguing about this dispute that I had, one of the lawyers sat me down. I was actually sitting in a room with four lawyers at one point. They were all on my payroll. And I was paying every one of them, but they were all my adversaries. Every one of them were being adversarial with me. And
so you're saying this gives you insight into what happened with Palin?
I think so, yeah. Because, let me finish the story. Because what they said to me was, oh, you could be right here and you could win, but you'll be bankrupt at the end of it. And bankrupt.
Yeah.
I'm not bankrupt. I'm actually very well off. And so the thought of being bankrupt is not something that appeals to me at all. And being right, while being right is important, you know, and being proven right and vindicated is important. It's not as important as not being broke.
Right.
And I think that's what happened here. I think she was looking at this situation. She saw the mounting legal bills. She doesn't have the money to pay the ones that she has right now. She's going to go deeply into debt defending herself. And this is the only defensive action that she has. This is the only way out of it, is to try to kill those ethics investigations by no longer being a legitimate target of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's standing up there telling her story, and she says at many points in the explanation that, you know, the press isn't telling my story. You know, those aren't the exact words she used. I think she did the best that she could. You know, there's a lot of that going around, is that people, you know, I've become a much better writer over the years, so I can express myself better, but my ideas were no less good 20 years ago when I wasn't as good of a writer. So she wasn't saying it eloquently or even very well, but she was saying the press isn't listening, and the press is raking me over the coals. And I think she was right. And I think she was standing up there saying, look, I'm a source, and I'm going to go direct. And for that, I know it's a reach to say that you're inspired by it. Maybe you don't get inspired by it, but I do. I don't.
How
like
is she going to go direct? Okay, so she's a source going direct. So how do you see her doing that?
She did it. What was she doing in that press conference? She got up and stood up and told her story. Why isn't that sources go direct?
Well, it is, but politicians get up in front of journalists and talk all the time and say, here's what I believe and here's what I'm doing and here's
but
why.
But they don't say what she said. They don't say, you're not telling my story.
Uh-huh.
You don't see it?
No.
Okay.
No,
well,
not at all.
You're right. Okay.
She's incapable of telling her own story, and she consistently fails at it because she's wound her political appeal up in a politics of resentment directed at the press, and the press is actually a constitutive part of her political personality, which is why before she was even introduced to the American people in her acceptance speech at the convention in 2008, which is when we're first learning about her, she includes in her introduction the resentment she already feels at the press. And what I feel she did was take this cultural meme that was powerfully introduced by Agnew in 1969 and incorporate it as a building block of her political house. And by doing that, she guaranteed that an atmosphere of culture war and rage would surround her because she becomes the lightning rod and she becomes the attraction point for the already existing animus towards the press on the right wing. And she attracts through her own victimization, the media attention that she can then spin into more tales of misrepresentation. So it's not like just sort of a side issue in her quest to tell her story. It's intrinsic to her appeal. And and the McCain forces decided that they would launch Palin and at the same time basically have a culture war campaign that would try to widen.
Well, I agree with everything that you're saying.
Okay,
so
that's who she is. That's who she is. She is the instrument of culture war.
I think something changed. I think there's a change there, okay? I think this last speech was none of that. And it depends on what actually happened, okay? You know, if what she was doing was the next step in the process of setting up that culture war, then you're right, okay? If, on the other hand, it was the end of her career, in this instance at least.
Oh, I think it was the end of her presidential career, absolutely.
Okay. Well, in that case, it's no longer what you're talking about. So
no, this is who she was. This is who she came to prominence
absolutely.
Around this.
That's why I didn't call her the inspiration when she... I mean, when I watched her give the speech at the Republican convention, I agreed with what Frank Rich wrote about her speech, which is even stronger than what you said, is that she was lifting, or her speechwriter was lifting ideas out of Nazi sympathizers prior to World War II.
I wouldn't go that far, yeah.
Well, he did, okay, yeah. And I thought there was something to be... You know, remember how scary those times were. I mean, the thought was at that point... we have 90 seconds, by the way. The thought at that point was actually he was ahead. McCain looked like he had a chance of winning. And
yeah,
she
I remember
had a
that, yeah.
Of being the vice president. So it wasn't an idle concern here that we were electing a neo-fascist, you know, vice president. But it's not that now. Now it's a family that is, you know, and I don't say that I know that this is true. This is what I saw. And the inspiration that we derive from this is only that idea that, you know, here is a, if I'm wrong, I think it's still the inspiration, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it just didn't turn out the way I thought it would, okay? So
well, the power of sources going direct is visible in her standing before the cameras and telling her story. Yeah, I can see that.
Well, That's maybe it isn't my strongest choice for source of the week. Okay?
I think,
but I'll
did.
Stand there with it. I'm going to stand by it, and we'll see how it turns out. I have a feeling that it's going. I really feel that it's going to have to be that. That was what she was doing up there. So.
Well, to Sarah Palin's culture war, I say, peace, man.
And that's the way to end this episode of Rebooting the News, Jay. I'll talk to you again next week, okay?
Been a pleasure, Dave. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.